Welcome. I'm glad you're here. This is Orthodoxy by G.K. Chesterton, using the Project Gutenberg edition, read slowly, aloud, and in company. These readings aren't lectures, and they aren't explanations. They're an invitation to listen carefully, to follow an argument that wanders on purpose, and to allow surprise to do some of the work. So let's take our time and see where Chesterton leads us today. Last time we walked with Chesterton along the thin line where reason, when it closes in upon itself, begins to resemble madness rather than sanity. Today we consider how, to use Chesterton's words, the parts seem greater than the whole. It is a paradox where the explanation of a thing appears to be so much less grandiose than the totality of reality. You've got to love Chesterton. Today's adventure pushes us toward the horizon of human possibility. It suggests that something opens when we escape the gravity of pure reason and rediscover imagination, possibility, and joy. There is no doubt that logic has revealed models of the world that have given us remarkable opportunities and new responsibilities. But can we still discern the possibilities of our human existence? Are we still open to being surprised by the tiniest imp, though it might be hiding in a pimpernel? With that tension in mind, let's listen to Chesterton.
Reading 5, lines 615 through 739 of Chesterton, G.K. Orthodoxy, 1908. Project Gutenberg ebook number 16769. It must be understood that I am not now discussing the relation of these creeds to truth, but for the present, solely their relation to health. Later in the argument, I hope to attack the question of objective verity. Here I speak only of a phenomenon of psychology. I do not for the present attempt to prove to Haeckel that materialism is untrue, any more than I attempted to prove to the man who thought he was Christ that he was laboring under an error. I merely remark here on the fact that both cases have the same kind of completeness and the same kind of incompleteness. You can explain a man's detention at Hanwell by an indifferent public by saying that it is the crucifixion of a God of whom the world is not worthy. The explanation does explain. Similarly, you may explain the order in the universe by saying that all things, even the souls of men, are leaves inevitably unfolding on an utterly unconscious tree, the blind destiny of matter. The explanation does explain, though not, of course, so completely as the madman's. But the point here is that the normal human mind not only objects to both, but feels to both the same objection. Its approximate statement is that if the man in Hanwell is the real God, he is not much of a God. And similarly, if the cosmos of the materialist is the real cosmos, it is not much of a cosmos. The thing has shrunk. The deity is less divine than many men. And, according to Haeckel, the whole of life is something much more gray, narrow, and trivial than many separate aspects of it. The parts seem greater than the whole. For we must remember that the materialist philosophy, whether true or not, is certainly much more limiting than any religion. In one sense, of course, all intelligent ideas are narrow. They cannot be broader than themselves. A Christian is only restricted in the same sense that an atheist is restricted. He cannot think Christianity false and continue to be a Christian, and the atheist cannot think atheism false and continue to be an atheist. But as it happens, there is a very special sense in which materialism has more restrictions than spiritualism. Mr. McCabe thinks me a slave because I am not allowed to believe in determinism. I think Mr. McCabe a slave because he is not allowed to believe in fairies. But if we examine the two vetoes, we shall see that his is really much more of a pure veto than mine. The Christian is quite free to believe that there is a considerable amount of settled order and inevitable development in the universe. But the materialist is not allowed to admit into his spotless machine the slightest speck of spiritualism or miracle. Poor Mr. McCabe is not allowed to retain even the tiniest imp, though it might be hiding in a pimpernel. The Christian admits that the universe is manifold and even miscellaneous, just as a sane man knows that he is complex. The sane man knows that he has a touch of the beast, a touch of the devil, a touch of the saint, a touch of the citizen. Nay, the really sane man knows that he has a touch of the madman. But the materialist world is quite simple and solid, just as the madman is quite sure he is sane. The materialist is sure that history has been simply and solely a chain of causation, just as the interesting person before mentioned is quite sure that he is simply and solely a chicken. Materialists and madmen never have doubts. Spiritual doctrines do not actually limit the mind, as do materialistic denials. Even if I believe in immortality, I need not think about it. But if I disbelieve in immortality, I must not think about it. In the first case, the road is open, and I can go as far as I like. In the second, the road is shut. But the case is even stronger, and the parallel with madness is yet more strange. For it was our case against the exhaustive and logical theory of the lunatic that, right or wrong, it gradually destroyed his humanity. Now it is the charge against the main deductions of the materialist that, right or wrong, they gradually destroy his humanity. I do not mean only kindness, I mean hope, courage, poetry, initiative, all that is human. For instance, when materialism leads men to complete fatalism, as it generally does, it is quite idle to pretend that it is in any sense a liberating force. It is absurd to say that you are especially advancing freedom when you only use free thought to destroy free will. The determinists come to bind, not to loose. They may well call their law the chain of causation. It is the worst chain that ever fettered a human being. You may use the language of liberty, if you like, about materialistic teaching, but it is obvious that this is just as inapplicable to it as a whole as the same language when applied to a man locked up in a madhouse. You may say, if you like, that the man is free to think himself a poached egg, but it is surely a more massive and important fact that if he is a poached egg, he is not free to eat, drink, sleep, walk, or smoke a cigarette. Similarly, you may say, if you like, that the bold determinist speculator is free to disbelieve in the reality of the will. But it is a much more massive and important fact that he is not free to praise, to curse, to thank, to justify, to urge, to punish, to resist temptations, to incite mobs, to make New Year resolutions, to pardon sinners, to rebuke tyrants, or even to say thank you for the mustard. In passing from this subject, I may note that there is a queer fallacy to the effect that materialistic fatalism is in some way favorable to mercy, to the abolition of cruel punishments or punishments of any kind. This is startlingly the reverse of the truth. It is quite tenable that the doctrine of necessity makes no difference at all, that it leaves the flogger flogging and the kind friend exhorting as before. But obviously, if it stops either of them, it stops the kind exhortation. That the sins are inevitable does not prevent punishment. If it prevents anything, it prevents persuasion. Determinism is quite as likely to lead to cruelty as it is certain to lead to cowardice. Determinism is not inconsistent with the cruel treatment of criminals. What it is, perhaps, inconsistent with is the generous treatment of criminals with any appeal to their better feelings or encouragement in their moral struggle. The determinist does not believe in appealing to the will, but he does believe in changing the environment. He must not say to the sinner, "Go and sin no more," because the sinner cannot help it, but he can put him in boiling oil, for boiling oil is an environment. Considered as a figure, therefore, the materialist has the fantastic outline of the figure of the madman. Both take up a position at once unanswerable and intolerable. Of course, it is not only of the materialist that all this is true. The same would apply to the other extreme of speculative logic. There is a skeptic far more terrible than he who believes that everything began in matter. It is possible to meet the skeptic who believes that everything began in himself. He doubts not the existence of angels or devils, but the existence of men and cows. For him, his own friends are a mythology made up by himself. He created his own father and his own mother. This horrible fancy has in it something decidedly attractive to the somewhat mystical egoism of our day. That publisher who thought that men would get on if they believed in themselves, those seekers after the Superman who are always looking for him in the looking glass, those writers who talk about impressing their personalities instead of creating life for the world, all these people have really only an inch between them and this awful emptiness. Then when this kindly world all round the man has been blackened out like a lie, when friends fade into ghosts and the foundations of the world fail, than when the man believing in nothing and in no man is alone in his own nightmare, then the great individualistic motto shall be written over him in avenging irony. The stars will be only dots in the blackness of his own brain. His mother's face will be only a sketch from his own insane pencil on the walls of his cell. But over his cell shall be written, with dreadful truth, he believes in himself.
I love it when Chesterton suggests the really sane man knows that he has a touch of the madman. I think of when his fictional detective, Father Brown, admits that he solves cases because he becomes the murderer. Around the age of 9 or so, I had a dream. It scared me half to death. To be honest, in my whole life, I only remember 2 dreams, this one and one I had in my late teens. I don't doubt that this early dream impacted my path more than I am willing to admit. The dream began with me being alone in the darkness of the universe. The odd thing is that this did not scare my 9-year-old mind. It is what happened next. Between my 2 fingers, I held a minute piece of, well, for lack of any other description, let's call it Play-Doh. I proceeded to pull it in 2, and it would not stop dividing. The nothingness would soon be so full that there would be no more room. The idea scared me, because I felt that by pulling it in 2, I had started something that would become so big it could not be contained. I had broken reality. I never had that dream again, but over the years, I have had to push that feeling out of my mind. It no longer scares me, but I wonder if this is not a bit of what Chesterton is getting at in this reading. The pure and unlimited horizon of Christianity, the religious mind, as compared to the limited logic of a materialistic understanding, or the self-limitations of one's own certitude that only perceives what is a lump of Play-Doh or an image in a dim mirror that cannot expand and grow. Is part of modern humanity's condition the continuation of the logic by which humanity seeks to fit the world into its order, rather than seeking how humanity fits into the order of the universe, God's order? Do our perceptions equal reality? Or are they merely the limits of our faculties? Do bigger worlds exist beyond our imagination? Or are they only accessible through our imagination? Next time, Chesterton pushes the question further, wondering whether the most reasonable response to the world is not explanation but astonishment. Let's meet again in a couple of weeks. Until then, God bless and be well.